Welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast, created by Mark Shepherd and now run by me, Thomas Manuel. This episode is on time and on schedule, despite my many foibles and flaws. When I invited Quince onto the show, I sent him the invite on a long defunct email, so he never saw it. If we have this episode today, it's because Quince reached out to me, you know, proactively, which means that A, he takes getting the word out about his new review show, Quince Quest, very seriously. And also B, he's a listener and fan of the show, which means maybe I'm doing something right. And if I get to do this at all, it's because of everyone on Patreon who supports this podcast and the newsletter. So thank you for doing that. Thanks for supporting me. That said, let's get to the interview. And I'm sitting down with Quince today. Quince has been reviewing board games for more than a decade with the iconic show Shut Up and Sit Down. Then about 3 years ago, he joined People Make Games to cover everything from Roblox's relationship to child labor, to the battle for ownership and control of Disco Elysium, from the revival of Kabaddi in India to the phenomenon that is Jubensha in China. Now he's gone and started Quince Quest, a new YouTube channel to review tabletop role-playing games that feels a lot like that one show where William Riker from Star Trek looked at the camera and asked us if we believe in ghosts. Don't worry, listeners, we're going to ask the question that's on everyone's mind. Why? Just kidding. Quince, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Thomas. Really excited to be here. Big fan of the podcast, so this is a fun appearance for me.
I'm a big fan of yours as well.
Let's just talk about how much we like each other for 45 minutes.
I'll stop recording right now. I just want to dive into the deep end today because I feel like we could spend an hour talking about this. So straight off, when you're reviewing games just at Shut Up and Sit Down, you must have developed some kind of rubric or rule of thumb for what makes a good review. So
Yes.
Other than the number of funny faces you can make in 10 minutes, what are the other qualities of a good review?
For us, I mean, different reviewers all have different styles and different priorities. For us, it was all simply about honoring the game, asterisk most of the time, and then really respecting the audience's time. When we started Shut Up and Sit Down, we were trying to fill a gap in the market of the kind of reviews that we wanted to see, which is if you're giving us 10, 20, 30, 40, goodness, minutes of your time to review something, then we want you to be rewarded for giving us that time. So we want to make sure not just what the rules of the game are, but what it feels like. We want you to know not just whether we think it's good, but whether it's a good fit for you. And some of my favorite pieces of feedback to get after a review is someone will say like, oh yeah, you really hated this game, but I watched the review and I knew it was for me. And I'm like, great, then I'm doing my job. But then also part of that idea of respecting time is like, there's no reason if you're giving qualitative judgments for 20 minutes, why that can't also be funny. You know, if you want to talk about the fact that a game is slow, you can get that across with a funny analogy that I absolutely cannot think of now. My favorite authors of novels are people who are able to, you know, it's trite to say make you laugh and cry, but I do believe that humor is something that can be like, you know, like icing on a cake spread on top of whatever existing thing you've got.
Yeah. So what does, I mean, I like both of the things you said, being true to the game and respecting people's time. I think that makes a lot of sense. What does being true to a game mean? Like you said that it means communicating what it feels like and making sure that anyone who watches this gets a sense of if it's for them or not. What does being true to a game mean when it's like, you know, an abstract tile laying game?
I mean, an abstract tile laying game is a tricky example. I mean, in that case, I think that's a more straightforward job of judging it based on, you know, what other games are in the space or, you know, what the author is really intending to do. But I think honoring a game often for us comes out when a game has a theme that is perhaps historic or touches on something that we don't fully understand. And I also remember that when I was working on magazines, there's a rule of thumb that you should always test a game in the environment that it is designed for. So, you know, some of the most challenging reviews in Shut Up and Sit Down's history is when, like, I don't know, when we reviewed Don't Get Got, That is a game that really wants six people to be playing it in the background of a party. And I was sat on a review copy of that game for a long time before my friends were having a house party. And then I was like, okay, wait, I need to subdivide this friend group into six people who really like this game. And then that was a wonderful evening that involved someone winning a point by falling down a flight of stairs, because the what they had to get their friends to do was help them up off the floor. So fully just pancaked off of five stairs, hit the ground, and my friend ran over and went, "Are you okay?" And he went, "Yeah, but you've just given me a point." And then sometimes that is even more challenging if we're talking about campaign games that require, you know, you to play it 15 times. Naming No Names, Pandemic Legacy, which has on three separate occasions caused me to have a really difficult week. Yeah, it's about making sure that whatever a game, whatever environment a game is designed for, you play it in that environment. Which has been really interesting now I'm reviewing RPGs, because RPGs require a great breadth of tone and interest in the kind of stories that we tell. And so curating a friend group to play RPGs with has been a real challenge.
I did want to go there next, which is this idea that reviewing RPGs comes with a certain well-documented list of challenges. I think Robin Laws, a long time ago, wrote an article calling it the invisible art, where he's like, it's, you know, how do we even review an RPG, you know? And it seemed like, I think from reading that you get a sense that it's sort of theoretically impossible. What are the unique challenges of reviewing RPGs that you've already kind of had to wrestle with?
Well, honestly, I think my white man overconfidence that has accompanied me my entire life allowed me to start the project of Quinn's Quest without realizing exactly some of the philosophical problems of reviewing an RPG. Like, you know, if there's a problem in a board game, that's enormous. And I was a video game reviewer for 10 years before I was a board game reviewer, and a problem with a video game is even easier. You know, a board game you can theoretically house rule, a video game you categorically can't. With RPGs, I find myself house ruling stuff without thinking about it. Yeah. And like, you know, the first review on Quinn's Quest is of The Wild Sea, a great game by Felix Isaacs. And it does have problems, which I just didn't engage with because I didn't use those rules. And I mentioned that in the review, but it puts you in a peculiar place. I think I got involved in a really good Twitter thread since the launch of Quinn's Quest, where someone used a helpful phrase for me of like, when reviewing an RPG, you have to consider what the game is trying to do and consider whether it succeeds at that. So you have to, it's where with a board game, it's like, did I have fun? With a RPG, it's more like, did I experience what the designer intended? It's very woolly. It's very peculiar. And I'm looking forward to spending the next few years losing my mind trying to figure it out.
I mean, that feels a lot like what you were saying about being true to the game, right? It's the same principle of like, what was this game trying to do? What is the, you know, I guess to some extent, there's a difference, but I think it is a subtle difference between what is the marketing pitch for this game, what is the promise it's making to me as a potential player, and is it delivering that?
Yeah, something I found really interesting recently is I've started dipping my toes into and getting those toes bitten off by the game Mothership. You know, what is obviously pitched as a horror game of you know, dying in space, creepy environment. But the more you engage with Mothership, or at least certainly the modules, the official modules, and hearing the designers talk about it, there's a few things that really caught me by surprise. The first of which is the Sean McCoy, one of the designers, has talked about how he likes to engage with RPGs as escape rooms and doesn't do a lot of improv, which is really not kind of what I do. And in another interview with Weird Science Magazine, he talked about how fear is an almost impossibly difficult thing for an RPG to muster. And really what Mothership is trying to do is create tension, but also, you know, Sean McCoy is a graphic designer by trade, and you can tell that reading Mothership. Those books are spooky to just look at. And so, and I think Mothership is heavily marketed on the idea that this is scary, of horror.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to get quite a ways into it into engaging with the design before you realize it's sold on horror, but it's trying to do tension. And so how do you review something like that? It's tricky and interesting.
I think it comes down to either you accept that a game can be scary, like theoretically, you know, whereas I don't think Sean McCoy does. Sean McCoy is like, believes that you cannot write a rule that is scary. Like, that's not a thing. And I think it's just a conceptual choice, right? And a lot of horror anyway, for like people who describe themselves as fans of horror, is not particularly getting scared, right? You can approach horror with a sense of irony. You can just enjoy the aesthetics of it and not be scared at all. And sometimes, yeah, sure, you like it because, you know, your heart rate goes up. And then when it comes down, it feels good.
Yeah, for sure. I and this is just a personal taste thing, but I get a little alienated by fans of horror who are like, oh yeah, I laugh all the way through horror. And I'm like, what are you doing? Engage with the dark stuff of humanity. You have to be, I am a fan of horror, but, and have been for a decade, but that has just seen me pursuing, I don't know, like darker and darker depths to try and feel like the, you know, like I did watching The Ring when I was a teenager. And I do believe that horror games can be scary, but, and this is another thing I've been getting into with reviewing, is how much of, I don't know, wanting to meet games where they are, right? Like, that's what we've talked about so far. I always want to do my best as a GM, but I think one of the truths of role-playing is that a good GM and good players working in tandem can, is a superior experience. A good table of players with a bad game will have more fun than a bad table of players with a good game, right?
Yeah.
So, but then I'm trying to GM out of my skin. I have, you know, like super grim soundtracks by Hacks and Cloak playing when I play Mothership and really trying to conjure some horror out of the game. And I think I did succeed in places.
Okay.
But then how does that affect my review if the game really isn't kind of designed to scare you, but I tried to make it scary?
Yeah. I think that's a big question about how you divide credit. Right.
I like what you're saying there. That does imply that at the end of every Quinn's Quest review, I should be, and you know, I give a really good mark to Quinn's, the real winner of this review. I was a great GM. It was awesome. Actually, honestly, that's kind of the stuff that people are going to get if they subscribe to the Patreon and get access to me just blogging, which is going to be like, I GM and I'm good.
And also your players, right? Like, I think, you know,
sure.
There is, like, for me, doing horror especially, it is extremely helpful when a player is going to allow themselves to feel a little scared. You know what
Correct.
I mean?
Correct. Yeah. I think,
and because if they don't want to, it's not going to happen.
Right. But if you have a table of like three players, all of whom would quite like to feel scared.
Yeah.
And this is where you get into, I don't know, some of the mechanics of that we've seen in the Gauntlet's recent horror games, like Public Access, where players are encouraged to say what they are afraid of. And then the whole story and reality warps around them to make that the case. Like, I'm worried I'm not alone. And the GM's like, oh, I guess you're not alone in the house. Okay, I'll busk a horrible person who's downstairs.
The counterpoint to that is something like Bluebeard's Bride, which has a rule that basically says when you shiver from fear. Like, that's the trigger for the rule, right? So the game is assuming that you will want to do this. And when you do it, you'll want to be like, aha, I have triggered a rule. You know what I mean? It expects that you're going to engage with this kind of enthusiastically.
And I especially like in Bluebeard's Bride that players are encouraged to narc on each other and be like, I totally saw Alan get nervous there. Let's talk about why Alan is nervous. I think, I don't know. It's but this kind of, all these discussions, right?
Yeah.
Like the discussions I have had, like just like this one from being an RPG reviewer now, kind of officially for less than 2 weeks.
Nice.
The amount of philosophical and ludic and narrative discussions I've had about like, what is an RPG really? Are like, it's wild to me that still some of the core foundational tenets of what a role-playing game is and how do we do it and what are they for and how do you review them? Are like still really amorphous and undecided, which is not the case in board games and certainly not the case in video games. And I think that's just, it's the most exciting possible space for me to be working in as a critic, even if I'm going to be making mistakes and not being party to discussions that have been had over and over and over again because, you know, institutional memory in art is awful. But I'm excited, is all I'm saying.
It's interesting that you're saying that these questions have been answered in other spaces because I feel like, again, either they've been answered here as well and people just have differing opinions and will keep having that same conversation over and over again, or they've not been answered in other spaces as well, is where like I stand. Because, you know, how, like I listen to people review video games and like they will disagree about whether immersion exists. You know, and I'm like, I mean, if you disagree about whether that exists, then how are you talking about the same experience, right?
But I think role-playing game just gets closer to the kind, some of the earth of play in a way that maybe brings these questions to the surface. And what I'm thinking about here is like, there might have been one or two board games in the last 5-6 years that are designed to make players uncomfortable. And like, even then, it's within the veneer of fun. Like, the wonderful videographer, now editor of Shut Up, Sit Down, Tom Brewster, did a great review on John's Company, second edition, last year, which is a game about the British East India Company and colonialism, basically. And it made me more uncomfortable and unhappy as a British person reviewing it. And also, than I've ever had. But it did also make me annoyed to see, like, the American discourse on John Company. John Company, also made by an American author, and like, they're sort of like almost watching, let's look at Britain wrangle with its colonialist past. But at the same time, John Company really made me feel the absence of, where is the game that will make Americans feel shit? Like, that just isn't there. Where is the game that forces Americans to deal with what happened to, you know, the native inhabitants of America when the colonists arrive over 100 years or whatever?
Yeah.
Or, you know, anything else the American imperial machine has done. Anyway, but so board games and video games will do interesting stuff occasionally. Yeah. But I feel like role-playing games are doing interesting stuff and putting players in uncomfortable places all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think it forces the level of discourse to be higher because, you know, some of the most popular games in the space, like Bluebeard's Bride. Bluebeard's Bride had me questioning whether, as a male GM, to what extent my players would be comfortable with me narrating scenes that involve horror to do with, you know, like pregnancy or the patriarchy or whatever.
Yeah.
Which, tell you what, haven't had to do playing a board game.
Maybe. Okay, so one of the things I wanted to talk about is, what would it take for you to give an RPG a bad review? Because you've done negative reviews of board games, right? First of all, would you tackle it the same way? Second of all, what would be the threshold for you to start thinking like that? And I think it's perfectly fine for your answer to be like, you know, I would not do a review in that situation or something.
I think board games are such, well, first off, there is certainly a more negative review coming in Queen's Quest Season 1, which I've teased in a couple of places. But that is a game that's a bit of a darling. Okay. And I can't help but feel that a lot of the people upvoting that game's name whenever it shows up on Reddit have not played it, which is part of the thing with Queen's Quest, is obviously doing reviews of games that I have played, which is a terrible rod for my own back. But it's an interesting question, right? Because with a board game, I think straightforwardly, it feels like such a neat little box product that we can say, get this box, avoid this box. Yeah. And how many times do you need to play a board game? Whereas with role-playing games, often, not always, and I really look forward to when I'm reviewing more one-shots, but often you're looking at games that are designed to span like 10 evenings or something.
Yeah.
And that's a real time investment. But equally, it's a time investment people are only going to make if they're really excited by what that game is doing. So with a board game, I can just say like, hey, you know, don't buy, I mean, I wouldn't say this, but like, don't buy Azul, whatever. Like, it's not, I do buy Azul, it's great. But with a role-playing game, it's like, I'm going to pick a game at random. I'm just going to choose Teeth, which is a game I'd love to talk about more. Yeah. And I'm now going to do the immense disservice of talking about in a hypothetical negative frame. But I haven't played Teeth. I think it's awesome. I would love to play Teeth. Really excited by it. The designer is actually a friend of mine. But if I played Teeth and then had a problem with it, I wouldn't be like, don't buy this game, because it's like, there's not some huge swath of people who are desperate to buy Teeth.
Yeah.
Instead, I would say, I think, this is a game that does X. I'll say what Teeth does. It does, it's like Stalker, the idea of going into radioactive zones to collect weird artifacts, transposed into like Edwardian England.
Yeah.
And you're fighting monsters for the crown, kind of, in a weird messed up area of the north of England. Very cool. But if I had problems with it, I would say, here's what it does. Do you want to play it? Yeah, me too. Here's the things you need to know. And I think what will come closer to negative reviews on Queen's Quest is just games with a longer list of, here is the area where you have to apply extra elbow grease, extra imagination, extra Googling to get what this game wants you to get out of it. Versus, you know, games that are just like completely coherent products where it's like, get this, it's great. Do what the book says, you'll have a good time.
So there's a nice article I read by a namesake, I guess, Quinn Murphy, talking about how one of his criteria for whether a game is good or not is going to be consistency. The idea that, like, does the game suggest that it will be consistently good across for different groups in different places? In which case, that's a thing. Like, when you read a game and you're like, I could make this work. I don't know if somebody else can. I don't know if I have to be like, you know, firing on all cylinders to make this work.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because obviously I can only play games at my table. For sure, I think Quinn is right that is a great thing to look for in an RPG. I think for me, the way that would look is like, how hard did I have to work?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
playing Blades in the Dark or Slug Blaster or Bluebeard's Bride, those are games where the GM is encouraged to prep almost nothing. And I find that I can do that. But I also find when I'm playing those games, it's like, I would not want to play this with a GM who's not adapt and quick on their feet. But also, like, I find those games pretty tiring. I'm playing Slug Blaster at the minute, and I found that I have not played an RPG that has left me more shattered as a GM, partially because it's all improvisational for me, partially because I've been laughing so much.
Okay.
But what I would say is, so I think consistency is a really difficult thing to track, and a laudable thing for a journalist to try and track. Actually, I've got another C word, which is something that I want to try and measure with my games, is conciseness. I think now that I am reviewing games, I think designers can expect me in almost all my reviews to come down hard on the word count of a game. Especially, I guess, kind of maybe my background is trying to pack as much information about what a game is, how it feels like, what the thinking was behind it, and how entertained I can make you.
Yeah.
In my reviews, maybe perhaps because of my background, I'm more approaching books of like, why is this so long? Why are you making me? I mean, it's not even that it's so long, because I find often in RPGs, not too many words are wasted, although sometimes they are. It's more like, how hard do I have to work to find what I'm looking for? And yeah, if you watch the Wildseer review, you'll see something that will be a recurring theme in Quinn's Quest Season 1, which is the lore and background of your world in your game. Not just how much information of it have you given me, but have you covered the correct areas?
Yeah.
Like, is what you've written down in your book going to be relevant? And am I going to think about it as a GM? Do I have to tell it to my players? Do they have to read it? Yeah. Or could we just ignore it? More importantly, what have you not told me that would have been useful?
Yeah.
Ironically, that's me talking about conciseness and rambling, which I now feel deeply self-conscious of.
Not at all. I think, yeah. You know, there are some games that you pick up and you look at the size of the rule book and you're like, this was meant to be read. You know, like this comes from like a publishing ecosystem where people were going to buy these books and read them and keep them on their shelves and potentially not play them, you know?
Yeah. Do you have any idea about it? Because I know you sometimes get into analytics and stuff. Do you have any idea what fraction of books get bought and then are then played?
I mean, that is extremely like hard to find out because it's not something that any one platform could even know. But if you look at the best-selling PDFs on DriveThru, they tend to be these big, fat games. They tend to be trad games. They tend to be supplements for trad games. They also tend to cost more because of that, right? Like, I mean, it's still, I mean, they're not absurd amounts, but like a $30 PDF sounds strange to people potentially. But these books absolutely, like, you know, and they'll be like 300 pages because they're trying to like give you value for that or whatever, so.
Yeah, that is cursed. The idea that to hit the right price point on your PDF, you have to put in more content.
Yeah.
And then that makes the PDF less usable as a game, but technically more of a book.
Yeah.
That is horrible. That is something that we can't stand for or that I will not tolerate in my reviews. I have been also paying a lot more attention to layout, really. I think there's lots of discussion around that, but how you format information in your book is, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like the TTRPG community in the last 4 or 5 years has really started hiring layout and editors more as part of the course.
Yeah.
And thank God, because you can so feel it when you read a book that doesn't have layout or an editor and you're looking for information. And
You said on Quinn's Quest that you're going to review games only after playing them.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you feel about that? As just like a pragmatic hard limit of how many videos you can make. Is that a good thing?
You know, maybe it is a good thing because it does mean that like one of the hardest things of being a YouTuber is the content grind. And it's why I've always done my work through donations and Patreon, kind of that's how it gets funded as opposed to trying to survive off YouTube ad revenue, which is just like, I don't know. That's just, you know, those little things in hamster cages, which are like a ball bearing in a tube and you have to put your tongue to it to get a single drop of anything. That's what YouTube ad revenue feels like. So maybe I wasn't really thinking of it this way. I just thought the honorable thing for the designers who've spent years on a release is to actually play the thing and not talk about it hypothetically. And to be clear, that so far has been a really fruitful choice for me because my reviews take a very, very different shape after playing a game. Like, you know, sure, 80% of it plays exactly how I thought. And you could, I think, get like 80% of the way to a good review by just reading a book. However, that 20% you're missing out on is the best 20%. because it's the stuff that is surprising. It's, I think, where the best, like, it's where the design and the layout really comes to life. Like, I don't know, you can, yeah, you can read a book and review it, but you can't judge like the order of information until you've had, you know, four people waiting for you to find a rule reference and you're flicking through the book panically. Yeah. That's the test. Oh yeah, no, but the good thing is that it means that there is a limit on how many reviews I can do. And I do think that's good because burnout is so real. And also because I think I do my best work when I'm passionate. And in, I think I'm probably going to aim for a little, a review every between 3 to 4 weeks until I reach the end of a season. And then I'm going to take a break. You know, you can still support me on Patreon. I'll still be doing blog posts and stuff. And then sort of build my stamina back up and go back into it again. Because yeah, it's crazy to sometimes like to have to play a game 8 or 9 evenings straight before you can review it.
I really feel the sorrow and tension when you say the word burnout. Like we don't have to get into it, but I can tell that you've wrestled with that hard.
It's really tricky. It's really, yeah, because like, yeah, all my best work is produced when I'm passionate and nothing burns the passion out faster than burnout. And then the whole job is just impossible because you're trying to fake or conjure a feeling of excitement about a product that you don't really feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I'm proposing is organic, like farm to table reviews produced by like a happy, like sort of livestock animal, which is me. There's like, imagine me in a barn, just relaxed, eating hay, playing games when I want to, doing reviews when I want to. And you know what? Those reviews are going to taste great.
You know, when you were talking about the 20% that's good, like I really connect with that because for me, when I try to review stuff, like I have completely stepped away from the idea that at the end of the review, I tell you whether the game is good or bad. And yeah. I fully lean into the fact that I want to tell you about this game from this kind of personal, individual standpoint. I want to tell you how I felt, et cetera, et cetera. And to do that, I really need to have experienced it, to talk about my experience.
Yeah. And I think that's some of the most color in the RPG reviews I've been writing is, because, you know, there's nothing worse than, I mean, lovingly, but if you've been like in a bar or something and someone's like, oh, you role play. I role play. I play D&D. Let me talk to you for 12 minutes about my paladin. And you're like, I don't have the context for this. I have never been more bored in my life. And yet when you're doing a review, I think that what I assumed would be self-indulgence of like talking about what happened in my campaign actually really brings the game to life in a way and makes it less abstract. Do you find that when you are reviewing games, you are surprised by how they play when you play them?
I think I am, but I fully believe that, like I had Layla Edelman, who's a designer and reviewer on the podcast, and she talked about how, because she's read and played hundreds of games, read thousands of games and played.
Yes, I listened to that podcast, yeah.
She's like, I can tell, you know, how the game is going to play from reading it. And there might be some stuff I miss. I think she said that. I do feel that there's a certain kind of, like, you can do that when the games are a bit samey. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you've read a lot of OSR games and you read another one, you can be like, I know how to talk about this without playing it. Like,
yes.
I think that's perfectly possible. But yeah, I do not have that. When I read a PDF or a book or whatever, I'm not like, I know the best parts of this. I have no idea. Like, I have to play it. And then playing it kind of like, is like the shock of cold water where I have to be like, oh, okay. That's how this would work. Oh, that sucked.
And to be clear, I think that's just you and I not having as much experience as and fully game recognized game, because when I had reviewed board games for like 10 years straight, I mean, it was 12 years by the time I stepped away from Shut Up, Sit Down to do Quinn's Quest. And yeah, when we reviewed something, I did play it. That is something that for sure happened. But the number of times I could read a manual and estimate within, like, we don't grade games out of 10.
Yeah.
But the number of times I was wrong about where that game would rank on a 0 to 10 scale after reviewing board games for 7 or 8 years almost never happened. Yeah. I'd be like, I think this is a 9 and it would be, or I think this is a 7 and it would be. And then we don't use the numbers 2 through 6 because that's how ranking games out of 10 works. That's not true. You don't use the numbers 0 through 5 for some reason.
I want to talk about that. Because there's, like, I don't do negative reviews, but what I'm interested in, as somebody who's been making these reviews publicly, Like, I am sure that you've experienced this thing of people reviewing your reviews, right? Like this constant feedback.
I would avoid that like the plague, but I don't think it happens as often as you'd imagine. Or I've successfully curated my internet so I don't see it.
What about just in the, do you read your comments?
We have to create, because otherwise you don't know what's growing in there. And then it turns out it's fascism. So in terms of, but comments on the review, whether people agree or disagree, for sure, I read the comments. Yeah. But not like if someone has written a full like blog post about, like if someone's written more than 100 words on their thoughts on the review, that's not getting read. No way. Thank you, madam. Not interested.
I guess the, if you don't do that, you get a weirdly worse version of it, which is that people on Reddit will do this weird parasocial thing where they'd be like, you know, their reviews aren't like coming out often enough. Are they fighting? Like, you know,
It's weird. It's weird being a reviewer. I've been really making contacts with designers and publishers and certainly other journalists who I can, you know, like, really, really couldn't be more excited to make friends in this space and, you know, to sort of like create a positive atmosphere around me and my presence, because it's a really privileged position to be in. But, you know, Quinn's Quest in the first 10 days got like 150,000 views or something. And like, obviously that's from zero subscribers. So I'm just getting started, which is great. You know, the project's already on its way to being sustainable. Couldn't be more happy for my fans that they exist, so generous. But I still feel it's really uncomfortable to be so instantly visible in a space where I feel like, you know, I've been playing RPGs to some extent all my life. I've been certainly reading them like it's going out of style for the last 2 years because I knew Quinn's Quest was coming up. But I still very, 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 very aware of what I don't know. And to be given such a big platform when all I can see is the stuff that I don't know yet is unpleasant. Even though it hasn't, you know, caused any big blowback yet.
That's a feeling that I think everyone who talks about games just kind of lives with. I try to talk to people about this, about like how they sort of work up the courage to have an honest opinion in public.
Like, you know, like... Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah. I've been doing it for so long that I've got like a full medieval suit of armor on now with regards to that. And I really like the analogy that when you're working on the internet, you build up a suit of armor that just gets thicker and thicker and thicker. But like any real suit of armor, you know, there are gaps. And, you know, like if you're fighting, if like, you know, non-knights were fighting knights in medieval times, you go for the armpit because you get a knife in the armpit, you wiggle it around. Then you're on your way to killing a knight. Yeah. And sometimes comments just get through your armor, specifically if they are about something you were self-conscious about anyway.
Yeah.
So you never like fully avoid it. But how do you deal with your sort of, not imposter syndrome, because if there's, it struggles to think of someone who's less of an imposter, but how do you get with, how do you handle the, what is that, how does that feeling manifest like for you?
I think a lot about everything I say publicly. Often I think the outcome of that is that nothing I say comes across as spontaneous. I think spontaneous.
Yeah, I hate tweeting for this reason.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think my Twitter is boring, and like, I think it's fine. Like, this is a thing that, again, like, I'm doing to protect myself, right? I play games, and if I don't like them, I just never mention their name. Like, you know, and I think that's fine. You know, I have enough stuff that I do want to talk about. And it's also this thing of like, I've discovered that I'm quite bad at trad games. And so now I tend to play.
Like, wait, bad at enjoying them or bad at surviving a dungeon?
No, like GMing them. Like, you know, like the skill that it takes of like, because a trad game will give you like half of what you need to run it. And you have to sit and prep and be like, just imagine the session in your head and be like, I should plan for this and I should do that. And I can't do any of that. So I'll have to just, you know, improvise it hard in the moment, and it feels like the game isn't helping me. And then I'll be like, this game sucks. And someone else will be like, I had such a great time with it. I'll be like, okay.
It's so weird, right? I did a really visible review on Spire by Rowan Rook and Deckard on Shut Up, Sit Down. It did really well for the company. They very kindly invited me to write the foreword to the new edition, which is lovely. I've got it on my shelf. But I was chatting to Grant Howitt and Chris Taylor, who make Spire and Heart and the upcoming Hollows. And like, it's just been really clear to me that they're such imaginative and inventive people.
Yeah.
That one of the criticisms I gave of Spire was like, you've built this huge world and there's much more consideration on all the weird and wonderful things in this world than there is on telling me what is on the street that we start the game on?
Yeah.
And I know from doing interviews with them that their line is like, just make it up. You're a GM. Come on, let's go. And like, I think it can only annoy them. And if I've read them correctly in interviews, it is annoying to them that like, they're making games of imagination. My criticism is like, well, you're making me think here. I don't, what? But for me, it feels like, you know, that the game, it's, they've built such a specific world. And even though there's wiggle room in there, yeah. Some of the, I'm not going to rehash my spy criticism because it'll just make them more annoyed. But yeah, it's weird, right? Like, to what extent is it a skill issue?
Yeah.
Is that like a reviewer of Dark Souls being like, it's too hard?
Yeah, I think for me, the way I've answered that, and I've also contributed to Spire, so I also am completely biased.
Oh, did you? Oh, great. Cool.
It was a fun assignment because I think it's a really fun world, but I also have asked Grant how do I start playing the game? Like,
good.
Like, what is the
that
first thing? What is the first thing I do? Like, you know, and so they went and they actually made these separate products that you can get on the website called Scenario Starters, where they solve that problem. They were like, here's the text you read, here's the thing. Like,
you know, Thomas, actually, they've released a product that I think is my favorite Spire product. Have you heard about the Conspiracy Kit?
I've seen it, but I don't know if I've read it. Yeah,
it's terrific. It's exactly what I think should be packaged in Spire Second Edition. So what it is, it comes with the GM screen, which is annoying because it's like the best thing you want for Spire packaged with the thing you don't really need. But the GM screen's nice. I'm not complaining. They also gave it to me for free. Definitely not complaining. But yeah, so the Conspiracy Kit is a bunch of postcards depicting NPCs and a bunch of postcards depicting locations like a pub and a temple. And there's information in the Conspiracy Kit as to who these NPCs might be. Like, here's a drow, here's an elf, here, whatever. And then in session zero, you put all the postcards down, like, you know, your interconnected red string thing. And you get players to each pick an NPC they like the look of and go, this is someone you know in the community, who is it? And the player comes up with, or like adds details for this. And so you build kind of your local neighborhood from fragments of concept art. Which is obviously great, because then when you go into session one, for a game about revolutionaries, the players themselves have decided on like things that they think are cool, things that they think are worth fighting for, people they know. And so it feels like we're revolutionaries in a city that we know because we built, almost like elements of like the Quiet Year in there, which I think is a much better start for revolutionaries than what Spire Session 1 tend to be, which is, hey, you've decided it's worth risking your life and your reputation to tear down the government. And they're like, what government? And you're like, okay, let me talk for 10 minutes about...
Yeah, that is a good point. Yeah. Generally, there's this whole genre of games that luckily I think is less common these days where you're supposed to be insiders, but you don't. The GM has all the insider knowledge and you're just sitting asking questions. Like,
yeah. And I hate that as a GM because I feel very self-conscious when I talk for a long time. When I'm watching something like Dimension 20 or Critical Role, and when the GM is giving exposition and it goes on for like 4 minutes, I'm like, I could never. I would die. You would watch me age behind the GM screen as I turn into a slug. And crawl away. Yeah. I just couldn't do it. But the games that expect me to do it, or like my, I would never give my players reading. I don't think they want to do that. Yeah, and I think lots of RPGs assume that that's what players want to do.
Yeah. Agreed. I'm connecting with all these answers, Quince. I think we have similar,
this is great.
Similar struggles.
Be friends. You're making me, this is great. Cause I do, for me talking about being anxious in the TTRPG space to you being like, no, Quince, these are all real things and you're not approaching the act of reviewing TTRPGs wrong. This is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, to finish a thought, which I never finished, I think. So because I play these indie games now, and cause I know I'm playing games that I think I like, and I'm more or less mostly right about that.
oh, you mean like you read them, you think I'm going to like this, then you play it and you're right.
Yeah, basically, exactly. I play games that I think I like, and if I don't like them, I tend to not talk about them. I would criticize them only if they were, you know, they had some kind of institutional weight, or they were classics, or they were some reason to be like this game, instead of being like the five people who have heard about this game. Hey, like, you know, just.
I am wondering whether to review D&D 1 on Quinn's Quest.
Yeah,
when it comes out.
I think that's great, like Patreon material. You know, because there's people want to hear your opinion about it, probably.
Yeah, but also like I wonder if we're about releasing it publicly, because. Could that be the thing that scrapes more players off D&D. If I'm, you know, like really friendly and I meet it where it is, but then I go like, listen, if you want XYZ, here are some
Okay. Actually, that makes sense. Yeah. Especially if a channel has a bunch of videos they could watch instantly after that, right?
And On the other hand, would it just annoy D&D players?
I mean, again, it's not as big a deal as we might worry about.
You're telling me we're not that important as tabletop role-playing game.
No, I just think that everybody who has a strong opinion about those things has already had that strong opinion and has nothing to do with us. You know, it has absolutely nothing to do with us. You know, most people who play D&D don't have a strong opinion about it, or do not connect with it as a lifestyle brand, do not make it part of their identity. And those people are fine. They will listen to you criticize it and be like, that's normal.
When I have friends who played long-running D&D games, and to them it's so much more about the ritual of meeting up every week than it is about the game.
Yeah.
They're never like, D&D's awesome. They're like, let me tell you what my annoying GM did. Okay, I get this.
All right. Okay. In the section called Infectious Enthusiasm, I ask, what's a game that you've had a lot of fun with that you want to recommend?
This was a tricky one because I didn't want to reveal stuff that I might be reviewing in the upcoming season, but I did get a good answer. So I chose Worldwide Wrestling by Nathan Paletta, which is a classic Powered by the Apocalypse game about being wrestlers, and it's a ton of fun. It's really gives you all the tools you need to be a professional wrestler and be an entertainer in that vein, even if you don't like wrestling or you've never seen it. In fact, that's very funny if you've got a table of three players who know wrestling and then a player who doesn't. Like, those matches are awesome. But the reason I wanted to talk about it is because it touches on something that we're kind of getting into with like games like Deathmatch Island that are exploring kind of reality TV. And I was talking about this in another interview, but I think it is a underexplored area that, and I think it's because like TTRPGs come from like this quite patriarchal, traditionally male scene, that games don't explore one of the areas of contemporary society, which is the most about playing with your identity, which is reality TV and game shows. And I think like if you want to see an example of people role-playing, just watch Love Island, you know, just watch Survivor, watch, you know, or watch professional wrestling. And I think Worldwide Wrestling is so fun for being about wrestling, and wrestlers are such like wonderful characters to embody, but also fun for letting you do an avant-garde game like Die does, which is who is your character, but then who are they behind the scenes? And I think there's room for much more role-playing games to explore reality TV and to explore the personas that people craft for themselves and then who they are really.
Nice. Yeah, that's a great answer. I think the draw of a wrestling game, which this game does execute well, I think, is also the fact that it's going to be funny. Like, you know, like it's not a game that's like a comedy game written in big letters on the front, but like you will have fun and it will be funny.
it doesn't force you to make jokes. Like Fiasco at its best is funny, but Fiasco does require a lot of improvising. Yeah. But if you have a good bad concept for Worldwide Wrestling, my wrestler was called Carboy, and he was just a good like lad from a small town who really loved his bad, slightly customized car, and did a lot of entrances on my car. And then of course other wrestlers would damage the car, and I would get really mad. Just great. As long as you have a good concept, the game properly just makes itself. You're totally right. Absolutely hilarious.
In the section Tyranny of Numbers, I ask, is there a number or statistic that you can share from your work that you think would be useful to my audience?
I don't know if this will be interesting, but 40 seconds generally into any YouTube video I do, I have lost, and this is true of all YouTube, 40% of my... I was really distressed when I first started getting analytics from YouTube about 10 years ago to see that your retention graph, which is a graph that starts at 100% and then gets lower as more people stop watching, so you can see if there's a part of your video that's boring or whatever, is like a... It starts off like a, what's an analogy? Like the drop
like
into a water slide.
Yeah.
So, and that has led to work where, you know, you try and put more cuts in and more energy, more changes in the first like 30 seconds of a video, but really there's nothing you can do about it. I think it's really peculiar to imagine you're like you're a stand-up comic, and then, you know, you're on stage and every time you do a show, because this is what it feels like, 40% or even more, 50% of your audience have stood up and left within the first 30 seconds. I don't know what your audience are going to do with that fact, but I think it's a revealing aspect of what being a YouTuber is trying to be like, no, please come here, stay. No, don't leave. It is really what's happening and the cornerstone of my career.
But what about auto-scrolling? What about that? Because I'm sure that number went up after YouTube was like, these videos are going to autoplay whether you wanted to click them or not.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that might be it. And I will say on TikTok, it's worse. That cliff makes sense. Yeah. On TikTok, like people will see your face because they didn't click on it and you'll go, hello. And they'll go, get the hell off my feed. It's like 75% of people are like, this is disgusting. Go away.
Okay. So my next section is called Replay. And it's where I ask people to share a gaming story. Do you have one? Do you have a gaming story?
I do indeed.
Oh, awesome.
I was wondering about what story to tell, because what a treat to tell a role player.
A captive audience. From your
Yeah, I know, right? They're stuck. I don't know how even long to make the story, but basically I've been playing Slug Blaster, the game where your players are a skate crew having like Bill and Ted extra dimensional adventures, which their parents basically don't understand and think slug blasting is dangerous, which it kind of is. And it's, you know, you run your campaign for a little bit, your skate crew burns bright and then ultimately falls apart.
Yeah.
Terrific game. Really, really phenomenal. But the archetypes, the playbooks that players can choose in it are sort of what you bring to the skate crew. So you might be the heart, you might be the chill. One of my players is playing the grit, which is kind of the Spider-Man. You fall over, well, I say Spider-Man, but very real teenage thing of like, you fall over and just get back up. Like, you will not be knocked down. And the maybe the best single feature in Slug Blaster is the way you kind of level up, sort of, is you have this arc. Every crew has a hard-baked series of scenes that player does to do with their class. So, for example, the heart is basically the first time you kind of spend style points, the game has tons of currency, on unlocking the scene, you kind of meet somebody, and then you fall in love with them. And then the fact that you're fully in love ends up causing major problems for the crew. And then finally, hopefully you get to the end of this arc before the end of the campaign. Otherwise, that's the ending of your character. Is like you find you're able to make good and your heart is big enough that even though you've been through heartbreak or broken hearts, that you're able to fix this for the crew.
Yeah.
It's terrific, and it's a mechanic I fully expect other RPGs to steal, because what players really want from their player character in a campaign is an arc.
Yeah.
And games don't give that to you. They expect this is like maybe a very complex narrative thing, but games just afford you no tools to do it. But Slug Blaster says, here's your arc, and players love it, in my experience. But so my grit player, that's all the long preamble. My grit player, the grit has an arc, which is you choose an impossible task and you try it and you fail and get hurt. And then you buy another scene and you try it and you fail and get hurt. And then the third scene in the arc is you fully give up. And the fourth scene is you go back to it and you do it.
Nice.
And I was playing, I have a player called Emily, whose character is called Rubix, and she's the only girl in the crew. And the game is set in 2005, and 2005 skate culture, you know, pretty misogynistic, pretty gatekeepy. And so when we were doing session zero, I was like, to what extent do you actually want to explore that? And she was like, well, I don't want to center it, but I don't want to paper over it. I want it to feel real that me being a girl in a skate crew is challenging. And I was like, okay, cool. And then when she started her grit arc, what she had narrated for it that blew my mind is she said, because it's meant to be like, I'm going to jump Devil's Gorge, I'm going to do the Kessel Run on my hoverboard, I don't know, whatever. But she said for her grit arc, I want to get more girls into slug blasting. And suddenly, and I was like, okay, that's wicked. I was never expecting that. But then also as a GM, it meant that it's like, oh, I gotta now do something which I obviously have cared about getting, you know, more women and, you know, more people from different backgrounds into games for, you know, like for a good chunk of my career. I think it's really important. It obviously makes the game better and more interesting, which is all I want. So it's even arguably self-serving. But so suddenly I as a GM are having to create plot points to make this a quote unquote almost impossible task that she ultimately gives up on. I'm having to role play, you know, misogynistic teenagers. I'm having to role play girls who don't get it and the problems that they face. Yeah. And it was just, I've been talking for long enough that I'll wrap it up there, but it was such a wicked interpretation of a problem that was just awesome to role play and really challenging and ultimately really rewarding for both her as a player and me as a GM. Even if I had to role play some really grody dudes.
That was a great story, first of all. Thank you so much for sharing it. But I think that's also this example of good game design, because it seems like it's saying, this is what's going to happen to your character. But because it's only half filled in, because it's like, what do you want to be the thing that you struggle with, right? It's a question. You get to bring what you care about. And suddenly it is personal. It's not a video game designer's level for you. Like, it's your level for yourself, right? Like,
you know. I think that's, to tie in what we were talking to about with Spire, I think like you and I aren't asking Spire to be like, and this is why the conspiracy kit is so good. You and I don't want Spire to tell us how to play.
Yeah.
We just want it to like half paint the beginnings of a framework of like, this is how you build a community. You can build the community, you can create the NPCs, you can flesh it out, but just a bit of framework is what you need. And that's what Slugblast is providing. A lot of open-ended questions that let you build.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It is hard to start with a blank page, and it is extremely easy to answer a question. In the last section, all advice is advice for myself. I want to know, what's a habit or technique you're trying to get better at your table?
Speaking of questions being fun to answer, I really loved thinking about all the various ways that I, as a GM, disappoint myself. Instead, what I'm going to do is big up Abriya Iyengar, because a famous GM for Dimension 20, super talented by all, like, appears a super lovely human being. But when I watch Abriya, I was first watching her in GM Court of Flame Flowers, a great season for Dimension 20 that brings Regency, sort of like Jane Austen elements to D&D. Really fun. And you know what she does that I'm like, I gotta steal that? It's what she does with her hands. She was constantly moving her hands in a way that, like, she doesn't repeat gestures too often, but she creates more motion and dynamism. She becomes a hookier thing to watch. And like, I am a GM who is so aware of like, and self-conscious about, I always want my players to not feel bored. That's like an impossible goal for me, but I will even do stuff like, I often light incense or candles at my table, because then it's almost like a visualizer. That if you don't want to look at me, or if I'm looking at the book or something, or not making eye contact, at least there is some movement on the table for you to pay attention to. And when I see Abriya using her hands, I'm like, yeah, I got to do more of that. And it's not like I did nothing before, but that I could always be doing more. And it's like, just, I don't know. I think it's part of filling the space and being an entertainer as a GM is just, you've got hands. That's a tool you can use. Use them.
Do you have, off the top of your head, an example of a hand action? I know.
Oh, God.
It's a podcast. I might cut this out. We can't communicate this.
Like, okay, let me describe to your audience. Like, let's imagine you were using the word nothing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you might do a sort of like sliding, like almost cutting of the neck motion with your hand to show that there is, you know, flat nothing here.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if you're talking about fireworks, you can do like sort of fake explosions in the air.
Yeah.
For the people at home, I'm doing this to Thomas on webcam.
Yeah. It's really good. It's really good.
Yeah. Oh, great. Cool. Love it. But also, you know what I will do that is really good and actually is a super simple tip that GMs can use? You know, when you're describing a scene and then a player cracks a joke, that's great. When I was 16, I would be annoyed at players cracking jokes because I'm like, I've got a flow. I've got an atmosphere going. You've taken all the wind out of the scene. Now I'm a grown-ass man. I'm like, jokes are great. Let's have fun. But as a GM, you have to pick that thread back up, right? You have to go back into describing what you're doing.
Yeah.
So what I will do often now is I will punch my fist into my open palm. I'll be like, right. And that is like just, it's a sort of moment to just snap players back in. It's like, it shows that it's not like aggressive. It just shows that I'm warming myself back up. And it sort of lets the players acknowledge of like, oh, Quinn's has to now do the work of picking up a rope. We will do the work of, you know, paying attention and doing active listening. And then with nothing more than your hands, you can better segue from like, and also if I put my hands down, that then, if I'm always using my hands when I'm narrating, if I put my hands down, that's a way of saying like, giving the players more agency in that moment. I don't know. This is one of the reasons I don't love playing games over a computer is, I don't know. I think so. When people say like so much of communication is nonverbal, I really, really feel that at my table.
I will say that I think all of that was great, but I personally would hesitate to ever describe my job as entertaining my table. Like, I would, that's a recipe for making me feel bad. Like, that's a thing I've had to like consciously stop. I'm like, okay, like if I can fail at entertaining my table, then they can fail at entertaining me. And if I wouldn't ask that of them, I hope they're not asking this of me. You know what I mean? Like, it's just,
you know, I feel that it makes perfect sense. Yeah. That is such a healthier and better way to GM. And if I felt that I had to be an entertainer when I was starting GMing, I wouldn't have kept doing it. Okay. However, I am so entertainment pilled that I will admit this. This is an exclusive on your podcast. When my players leave my flat, I will sometimes put my ear to my front door to hear if they say, and they regularly do, that was a great session. And I'm like, great, now I can go to bed. Now I've heard them say that. Also, doesn't always happen. Sometimes I just hear them walking down the corridor in silence, and then I start to wonder if I've done a bad job. So yeah, this is not something I recommend. I'm just admitting this. This is a safe space.
I mean, if you're not actively soliciting compliments at the end of a session, you should start. Like, that's it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is great. Yeah. But even when I do stars and wishes, I encourage my players to point out stars from each other as opposed to me.
Yeah.
But I also do crave compliments.
Yeah. It is extremely rewarding to receive a star as a GM. Like, I think, like, it's so silly, but like, yeah, it does. It does.
Yeah. Help. Players give stars to your GMs sometimes. They don't look like they need it, but they do.
They pretend to be deaf, but they're not.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, thank you so much, Quinns. How do you want to do this outro? What links do you want me to put in the description?
Oh, I would just really love to point your audience towards Quinns Quest. That's all. I'm just getting started from zero subscribers, so any attention that the channel can get, so much the better.
And if you head over to Quinns Quest, you should be able to see Quinns' second review, which is about Lancer, the incredibly popular mecha game for people who like mecha a little bit too much. I think we can all agree about that, right? Right? Also, my next episode, which again should come out on schedule, is with Max Lander and Aaron King from the RTFM podcast. And we're going to be continuing this conversation about reviewing games. RTFM is a great show. It's a show that I would describe as being about D&D, except the first D stands for discussing games, and the second D stands for deconstructing masculinity. So, if that sounds good, check out the next show. See you then.
And cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, kryptonian, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.